Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Ari Barbalat. I am honored to be in dialogue today with my guest, Kelly Lytle Hernandez, who is the Thomas Lifka Endowed Chair in History at UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles, and the director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies, also at UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles. We are here to engage in a dialogue about her new book, Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands. Kelly, I could not be more honored to be in communication with you today.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's just a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you. To begin, please tell us about yourself. Were there any formative life events that inspired you to become a historian?
Well, I have to say that it's certainly my family that inspired me to be a historian, that they're all historical thinkers and very much engaged with history books in general. And the conversations around our dinner table were often political, but also the politics was very historically informed. So it was my family who gave me that curiosity.
What inspired you to write this book?
Well, that also certainly has something to do with my upbringing. So I was raised in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. In particular, I grew up in San Diego, California. And when I learned about the PLM, or otherwise known as the Magonistas, the rebels at the heart of the story, I learned about them first in graduate school. And I could tell immediately that their story was extraordinarily dynamic, consequential, and even cinematic. And I question, why did I not know this story growing up in the borderlands, right? It's a borderland story. It was about my community. And no one had ever told me it before. And I was just shocked and surprised and dismayed, and wanted to make sure that I always wanted to dig in more and learn more about it. So I spent years reading about the PLM. And then when Donald Trump referred to Mexican immigrants as bad hombres, I knew that there had been an autocrat before who had disparaged Mexican migrants as bad Mexicans, that autocrat being the dictator of Mexico, Porfirio Diaz. And I wanted to talk about all it was that President Trump at that time was stirring up when he talks about making America great again and disparaging Mexican migrants as bad hombres. And that story, in part, that question we can help to answer by telling the story of the PLM.
What is your book's message, thesis, and central argument?
So this book is about a group of Mexican dissidents who came to the United States in the early 20th century, 1904 in particular, to stir up, to incite a revolution against a dictator in Mexico. That dictator's name was Porfirio Diaz. And so the story of bad Mexicans, whom, you know, the dictator disparaged these dissidents as so-called bad Mexicans, tells the story of them building their social movement in the United States and across the border, and also the counterinsurgency campaign led by both the US and Mexican governments to try to shut down their revolution before it could incite an uprising that would remove Porfirio Diaz from power. And why Diaz is important is that he had invited many US investors into Mexico to buy up land and use labor. And so, of course, the United States government wanted to protect the interests of U.S. investors in Mexico. And so they joined with the Diaz regime in this counterinsurgency campaign to suppress the Magonistas uprising.
Can you share with us the history, a basic synopsis of the Mexican Revolution for those who might not be familiar and or who find the history of the revolution complicated to understand? Can you share a brief, if it's possible, summary of who did what to who in the Mexican Revolution as a background context to thinking about the Magonistas?
That's an extraordinarily difficult question. How do we summarize the world's first social revolution of the 20th century? And how do we summarize it in particular for a U.S. audience? Let me say this, that the people at the center of this story had a particular set of dreams for Mexico that they encompassed in a, you know, more than 50-point platform. But at the heart of that was both economic transformation and social and political transformation, that they wanted to see labor rights protected, land that had been taken from indigenous and rural communities returned to those communities. They wanted to see democracy protected, the vote protected, and child labor ended. So they had a particular set of economic and political dreams that were on the radical side of the spectrum. And so for them, the Mexican Revolution was about achieving those goals. And at the outbreak of the revolution, there was great hope that that might be possible. But of course, there are interventions that happen both internally within Mexico, but also from the United States that help to derail some of the more radical aspects of the Mexican Revolution. So I think that that helps to explain how there is an uprising between 1910 and 1917 that ends with a new constitution that is extraordinary in its content with the number of rights that it protects for Mexican citizens, including subsoil rights. But the contest about implementing that constitution, that document, continues as, you know, domestic elites and foreign elites try to determine the future of Mexico.
How has the Magonista revolt been preserved in Mexican collective memory? Can you comment on its place in Mexican art, historiography, literature, political discourse?
Absolutely. So when Mexico set about remembering the revolution and making it part of its historical canon, the PLM, the organizers and dissidents at the center of this story, often called Magonistas, they were identified as so-called precursors of the Mexican Revolution. And what that means is they did not go on to lead any of the armed battles or take major political positions, but they helped to incite the uprising. And so they are officially known as precursors to the Mexican Revolution in Mexico. And beyond that, since that time, largely the 1940s, they have been regularly remembered through all forms of memorial. Most significantly, or most recently, the Mexican government declared this year, 2022, to be the year of Ricardo Flores Magón. It's the centennial of his death. And so there's going to be a series of celebrations and remembrances for the man at the center of this story.
What is meant by the term Juan Crow?
Okay, great. So the term Juan Crow is something that scholars use to talk about the particular forms of racial discrimination and violence that persons of Mexican descent faced across the Southwestern United States, largely before the traditional civil rights movement of the 1960s and 50s. So what it means is the low wages that Mexican Americans and Mexican migrants faced across the region because they were deemed Mexican and racially inferior. It's about the forms of racial segregation, housing segregation that communities faced. And it's also about the extraordinary racial violence that Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans faced across the Southwestern United States, namely in Texas, between largely the 1870s and the 1920s. So that's what Juan Crow is about. Of course, it is a way of signaling that the story of Jim Crow in, across the United States, but you know, most of the literature is about the US South, that there were aligned forms of racial discrimination impacting Mexican immigrants across the Southwestern United States.
What kinds of sources did you use your research? How did you find them?
All right. So one of the great things is that much has been written about the PLM, the Maguinistas. And so there's a really deep historiography in particular in Mexico, of course, but also here in the United States. And I was able to use those footnotes and citations to track down the key set of documents at the heart of the Maguinista story. And it's a really interesting archive because the cross-border counterinsurgency campaign against them, agents within that campaign were able to infiltrate the United States postal system and basically steal and make copies of the PLM letters to one another. And then they would send those copies down to Mexico for an investigation, for using them to try to see if the US or Mexican governments could track down the Maguinistas wherever they went, because they were living on the run pretty quickly after they arrived in the United States. And so those stolen letters are at the heart of the Maguinista story. And what we're able to do is really get to the front lines of their revolution, their conversations with one another, their disputes with one another, their political dreams, but also just their personal dreams. And really it's those stolen letters that are at the heart of this story.
What role did journalism play in the Maguinista uprising? How does your book advance our understanding of journalism in Mexico, journalism at the turn of the century, and journalism in general?
Sure. Well, I don't think that this book advances our understanding of journalism in Mexico. There are scholars who are doing that work and dedicated to that. So I would certainly recommend looking at their studies. What this book does do is it provides a great introduction to people who are more familiar with US history about the vibrancy of Mexican and Mexican-American journalism across the borderlands and how politically engaged it was, how connected it was to politics in Mexico. And so too often there's a void in the general public understanding of Mexican and Mexican-American history here in the United States. And this story of a group of journalists, dissident journalists who crossed the border to come in and incite a revolution back in Mexico, really is one way to peek into the depth and the breadth of Latinx journalism across the borderlands during this time period. And of course, you know, these writers, these visionaries, these freedom dreamers were at the center of creating a new script of possibility, right? For Mexicans and Mexican immigrants, Mexican Americans and Mexican immigrants across the borderlands.
What can we learn about resistance from the Maguinistas?
You can learn that it's hard and counterinsurgency comes fast, right? So the Maguinistas are very quickly after they arrive in the United States in Laredo, Texas in 1904, within weeks, they're being followed by agents from the Mexican government, they presume. And so they have to shut down their shop in Laredo and move to San Antonio and then St. Louis. And then after a series of arrests, they are they begin living on the run. Many of them begin living on the run. So I mean, we learned that uprisings, especially the radical ones, counterinsurgency is extensive and it's quick and can be coordinated across borders and this really is a pretty extraordinary story of how you create a social movement under those conditions.
How does your book advance our understanding of police? What contribution does your book make to the history of police?
Sure. So one of my primary identities as a scholar, as a historian, as a historian of policing, and one of the things I find most fascinating about the PLM story is that amid the efforts of the US and Mexican governments working together to suppress the outbreak of the 1910 Mexican Revolution, Teddy Roosevelt establishes a new federal police force called the Bureau of Investigation in July of 1908, the summer of 1908. And that creation of a new federal police force, actually by happenstance, happens just a couple days after the PLM's most lethal, most dramatic set of raids on Diaz's Mexico. And so very quickly, the United States turns the power of this new Bureau of Investigation, which goes on via the FBI, to dedicate a good number of its agents to policing the PLM, to arresting them, to extraditing them, doing whatever possible to upend the beginning of the revolution. To me, that's important because rarely do we get to see how Mexican and Mexican-American history is at the heart of the story of US policing. And so this is just an example of when we begin to open up our lens to consider the centrality of Mexican-American history to the US experience. Here you find things such as the FBI, right at the beginning,
yes,
mass migration.
What does it mean to you to study Mexican history as a Black woman? What is unique about the perspectives you bring to the Magonista revolt from your own personal lived life? What interconnections, if any, are there between your personal lived life's autobiography and the story you tell in the book?
So that's a good question. So I am an African-American woman who grew up in the US-Mexico borderlands during the 1980s and the 1990s. And I think my experiences, my family experience, my perspective as a Black woman, the various literatures and histories that I remain a part of, in particular, helps me to see and to forefront the significance of white supremacy and race at the heart of this story. And so one of the ways that I'm able, in fact, this book about a revolution in Mexico, I'm very intentional to begin it with a lynching, an anti-Mexican lynching in Texas. And I think it is that lens, it is that perspective that helps me or brings me to, in particular, lift up the ways in which there are racial dynamics at play in this effort to suppress the outbreak of the Mexican Revolution. Because at the beginning of the 20th century, you see how white supremacy, well, late 19th century, is beginning to hinge from the settler state, the territory, to an imperial form. And so as white supremacy crosses border, I think we have to keep a close look at the racial dynamics of the Magonistas uprising and the suppression of it.
How does your book contribute to our understanding of international migration?
So for folks who are curious to learn about the origins of mass Mexican migration to the United States, I'll find that in this book. And that origin story is about as US empire grows and US investors begin to march south into Mexico, they dislocate millions of Mexicans. And that dislocation, at the same time of constructing new railroads to stitch together the US and Mexican economies, is what leads to the beginning of mass labor migration between Mexico and the United States. And so you begin to see that the incredible demographic changes in the United States in the 20th century is not about a set of individual decisions made south of the border, but rather it's structured in an economy that a binational economy, a global economy, that was being stitched together at the turn of the 20th century. So I would hope for folks to learn a little something about Mexican immigration history as they learn about or read about this group of Mexican dissidents who fought the power of foreign investors in Mexico.
Did you experience any setbacks, adversities, or challenges during your research editing and writing and revising process? Do you feel comfortable sharing what you went through? How did you grow as a person from what occurred? Is there any advice you might give to other authors, academics, and writers from your experience?
Well, I mean, I think COVID was a setback for all of us. This was a book that I wrote during quarantine. And so it certainly, in many ways, limited my ability to go to Mexico and work with the archives. I was fortunate because I had written on the PLM for my last book and had a pretty robust digital archive and was able to work with some graduate students in Mexico City to pull together any remaining pieces that I needed for this book. The benefit of that is that it helped me, I think, or encouraged me to lean more heavily on the secondary sources, many of which are already available on the story, and to think more conceptually about the meaning of this story for U.S. history in particular. I'm an archive rat, and so if you let me just stay in the archive, I would stay there all day and all night long. But having to pull back and really understand the meaning of this story in the context of U.S. history, I think that was a unintended benefit of being restricted from access to the archive.
What does your book teach us about justice and injustice, or injustice within in brackets?
That's a good question. That the struggle is ongoing, right? First of all, that many of the crises that we face today have extraordinarily deep roots, this just being one example of them. And historical perspective, I think, can help us to devise strategies, avoid mistakes, and pursue the kinds of changes that will dig up at the root of the injustices we face. I mean, that's a statement about why we need historical thinking and practice and study amidst social justice movements. And I think that certainly plays in this case, but across, you know, I'm also quite involved in the movement to end mass incarceration. It certainly plays out there as well. In this case, I think this story will help people to understand those deep roots of anti-Mexican sentiment, legislation, and policy and structures here in the United States.
If you had an expanded word limit, what aspects of the Maganista revolt would you include in this book that you could not? Were there any aspects of this history that you had to omit due to space constraints, but which are nonetheless important for their own sake?
Oh, there's just so many stories I had to leave on the cutting room floor of the ingenuity of the PLM and their activities. So that, unfortunately, I had to cut many of those stories. Also, just for streamlining the narrative, they were so active across the United States, in Mexico and beyond, that every foco, every cell, you know, has a story to tell, and you just can't be comprehensive with this kind of story. So that, I think, would be the first thing. I mean, I hope for me that this book is an introduction for many people to the PLM in particular, but again, Mexican-American history writ large. And so I'm not so concerned about the things I had to leave out, but really hopeful that it pulls more people in to wanting to know more about Mexican-American history in particular, Latinx history in general. So that for me is the goal of the book.
In regard to specific historical events treated in the book, can you comment on the importance of El Plan de San Diego? For those who are not familiar, can you explain what it was?
Sure. So after the Mexican Revolution begins and after the PLM, at least the form of it, led by Ricardo Flores Magón, really begins to decline. There is an uprising that happens, begins in Mexico, crosses the border to Texas with a plan to create a army for all races and peoples that will overthrow really white settler supremacy across the south, Western United States. The Army seeks to enroll Indigenous, Mexican, Japanese, and other folks, non-white folks, to participate in an uprising that will kill any white male over the age of 16 and seize lands across the Southwest United States. And among the first lands to be seized were to be given to African Americans as a sanctuary from white supremacy and as to Indigenous peoples as a sanctuary from settler occupation. This Plan de San Diego erupts in July of 1915, and it generates an extraordinary backlash across Texas in particular, where it occurs. And, you know, sheriffs and marshals and vigilantes across the region participate in a suppression campaign that is extraordinarily brutal. And historians now call that suppression campaign La Matanza, the massacre, which anywhere between 300 and some people have estimated as high as 5,000 Mexicans and Mexican Americans are murdered in retaliation for this plan of liberation. And so that's the relationship between El Plan de San Diego and La Matanza. And the relationship to the PLM is that several of the people who participated in El Plan de San Diego were all PLM adherents, members of Texas Focos. And it, you know, it's often seen as that the Magonistas or the PLM inspired this uprising, this radical uprising for that was anti-capitalist and anti-racist.
Can you share with us a basic outline of the life of Ricardo Flores Magón, or at least a synoptic biography of who he was, the individual behind this movement?
So Ricardo Flores Magón was a journalist based in Mexico City. And in the early 1900s, he starts alongside his brother a newspaper called Regeneración. And in that newspaper, they begin to question the Diaz regime. At first, it's under sort of cloak, but by 1903, they were outwardly challenging the Diaz regime and saying things like the Diaz regime had made Mexicans the quote servants of foreigners, and that the Diaz regime was despotic and autocratic. And so this is happening at a time when the dictatorship has criminalized really critique of any government member of government. So they're committing crimes by saying these things about Porfirio Diaz. And so they're arrested numerous times. They're sent to a horrid prison in Mexico City, Belém prison. And every time they get out, they keep writing, they keep protesting until 1903, when the Diaz regime issues a gag order against them, prohibiting any newspaper in Mexico from publishing the words of Ricardo Flores Magón and his friends. And it's that gag order that inspires them to leave Mexico and come to the United States to be able to continue speaking truth to power and continue inciting the outbreak of the 1910 Mexican Revolution. Now, that's his sort of professional profile, but I would say personally, Ricardo Flores Magón was a brilliant man who was a writer who had the power of the word. That certainly was his sword. He also was irascible, right? And could be vitriolic against his own friends and colleagues if they did not follow him politically. And so he's an interesting character who has wonderful dreams, but often problematic relationships with people with whom he's living and working in struggle.
Can you tell us about Margarita Magón? What role did she play in the revolt?
Yeah, I don't know if that's, you're talking about his
Margarita,
mother?
Yeah, what role did she play in relation to him, and can you comment on her role in resisting French rule?
Oh, okay. I thought you meant the PLM uprising. Well, there's a story that's been recorded by Ricardo's brother Enrique Flores Magón that their mother Margarita Magón participated in the battle of what's now known as Cinco de Mayo, right? When Porfirio Diaz was able to stop the French army from entering Mexico City. So there's a story that she and her soon-to-be husband, Teodoro Flores, supported the Diaz, well, supported Diaz in that battle. Sorry.
It's okay.
So it's a really, it's ironic that Ricardo Flores Magón and his two brothers grow up to become involved in the anti-Diaz uprising because their parents had been supporters of Diaz and actually helped to bring him to power.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can I ask you about the significance of the relationship between Magón and Emma Goldman? In what ways was Magón influenced by her ideas? And likewise, can you comment on the relationship between Bakunin and Magón, the ideas of Bakunin and Magón?
Well, I'll speak to the Emma Goldman piece. There are whispers in the archive that Ricardo Flores Magón met with Emma Goldman when he was living in St. Louis, Missouri, and working on Regeneración. We don't know what their conversations were. There's no record of the substance of their conversation that I'm aware of. But we do know that she's about to publish one of her major pieces, defining or giving us her definition of anarchism, sort of radical feminist anarchism. And so my assumption is that they were having those questions, or they were having those conversations about anarchism as he was making a shift in his own politics from socialism to anarchy. And so perhaps she influenced him. He would go on to become an anarcho-feminist as well. Perhaps he influenced her in terms of internationalism. But that's not totally clear, but we do know that there was a relationship between Emma Goldman and Ricardo Flores Magón that, you know, likely they influenced one another politically, ideologically. So for me, the significance of this book, why it matters to have written it for a US audience, in particular an English language audience, although it will be translated as well, is that the story of the Magonistas really strikes at the heart of US history in ways that we haven't been able to see because they're not included in the canon. And why it's important is because their story is really central. It's an uprising against the expansion of US empire at the turn of the 20th century, in particular, a white supremacist empire as the United States moves from invading indigenous territories across the North American continent to investing around in Mexico in particular. So the Magonistas uprising is an uprising against the expansion of U.S. empire. So that's how they're at the heart of the U.S. story. Their story is also at the heart of the beginning of mass migration from Mexico to the United States. And their uprising is central to understanding resistance against white supremacy within the United States. The ways that they have to organize and navigate the rules, written and unwritten rules of Juan Pro or white supremacy in the United States helps us understand what Mexican immigrants, Mexican Americans in particular are facing under Juan Pro. So So that's some of the reasons why taking this story that's typically understood as a Mexican history and contextualizing it within the frame of US history is important. It helps us to understand US history better. Now, we're often talk about Ricardo Flores Magón as the central character, and there's really no disputing that in many ways. But there are also many other key players in this story. Some of them are like Librado Rivera, who was a teacher from San Luis Potosí. He was a super quiet and reserved man who they called him El Fakir for his really kind of ascetic way. So he doesn't say much, but he's one of the most dogged and dedicated revolutionaries who follows Ricardo Flores Magón on the path from socialism to anarchy. There are people like Antonio Villarreal, who had been a literature professor in Mexico and actually had participated in a duel, killing a man and gone to prison in Mexico before he comes north as a so-called liberal or member of the PLM. He goes on to join the PLM. And there are women, extraordinary women, who really hold this thing together. As all these men are getting arrested and imprisoned across the country, it's the women who hold this together. Wow. And so there are people like Maria Bruce de Talavera, who is Ricardo's lifelong partner, who helps to smuggle rebel correspondence to him in and out of the LA County jail after he's arrested in Los Angeles. How does she do that? She pretends to be like this kindly woman and partner who's going to pick up his dirty laundry and drop off clean laundry for him. But what she had done was she had sewn into the seams of his clean clothes this rebel correspondence, letters to and from people in the movement and herself. And so she really helps to hold the revolution together when Ricardo Flores Magón is in prison. So that's just a few of the characters at the center of this story.
Do you consider Ricardo Flores Magón a tragic hero? Why or why not?
That's a good question. I see Ricardo Flores Magón as a problematic hero. His tragedy was of his own making, I would say, in many ways. Or his greatest tragedy. So Ricardo Flores Magón, as we talked about earlier, was this brilliant political thinker and intellectual and a writer. And it's his words that really helped to inspire many people to come to the revolution or at least think about revolution. And he really plays a significant role in his refusal to be quiet, in his ability to write. And so he is a hero in some senses because he helps people to see the conditions of their lives and to come to an understanding that things can change, right? To inspire them to work toward change. He's also tragic in the sense that he has a personality that can be quite combative even. So the person who can take down a tyrant is also the person who will attempt to take down a friend if they don't follow him on the path. And so in that sense, Ricardo Flores Magón is a tragic character as one historian has written, that his mind really was mightier than his personality. Oh. And so in that sense, I guess he's tragic, you could describe it that way.
On page 8 in your book, you write as follows. Few people in the United States know much about the Mexican Revolution and even less about the men and women who incited it. Typically, the extraordinary story of Ricardo Flores Magón and the Magonistas is folded into the corners of Mexican-American history, which itself is a little known in the United States. History textbooks have had little to say on the subject, and until recently, legislators in Arizona all but banned the teaching of Mexican-American studies in K-12 classrooms. Meanwhile, U.S. publishers and film producers persistently struggle to promote Latino voices, content, and experiences. However, as historians of Mexico and the Mexican-American experience have long made clear, you cannot understand U.S. history without Mexico and Mexicans. Can you elaborate on this problem? Why is this the case? And what do you suggest could be done to promote the study of Mexican history in American culture what can be done so that Mexican history is taken more seriously in American education and U.S. public discourse.
So one of the claims that I make in this book, and it's not an original claim, is that the 1910 Mexican Revolution transformed the United States by triggering a mass migration out of Mexico and into the United States. It really is the bedrock of the birth of the future Mexican-American generation. Many people in the United States today, many Mexican-Americans, can track their family lineage back to the revolution. And so I'm trying to put forth the idea that the Mexican Revolution is a critically significant event in the history of the United States, that it transformed who we are as a people, and therefore it's a part of our story. Why we haven't been able to see that story, you know, there's multiple reasons for that. Of course, it's the blinders of a nationalistic form of history, which is common. It is also the refusal to engage with Mexican-American stories within the textbook and the canon of American history, or U.S. history in particular. And, you know, as I say in the book, this is not a struggle just for publishers. It really is across media and storytelling industries. So how do we redress it? There's many things that have to happen. We have to continue to diversify who we accept as storytellers in the United States, the storytellers of our U.S. history in particular. We need to continue to build Mexican-American, Latinx studies programs, ethnic studies across the country. We need to shake up the canon and create entree points that are possible or accessible to new narratives. And this is what I think is just so brilliant about the 1619 project. Well, there's many things that are brilliant about it, but it really shakes up the settler narrative of the United States and creates a new way of thinking. And that has created possibilities for many fields of study. And so I'm eternally grateful to the work that they've done with the 1619 project to open up new possibilities in the story of the United States. And I'm hopeful that many of us can leverage that, right, to diversify the so-called American story with indigenous folks, Latinx stories, API folks, queer folks. I mean, the story goes on and on and on, but the shakeup, you know, has to happen first, right? The opening of the doors. So I think all that needs to happen. Super excited to be a part of that movement of transforming U.S. history and opening its doors to all the communities who have been impacted by the creation of the U.S. state.
How did the Maganistas perceive the church? Is it appropriate to ask you about the ways they viewed the Catholic Church, and how did they think of Christianity, either in contradiction of the church? What role did Christianity play in their thinking, and how did they view the Catholic Church as an entity?
So that's a good question, because it really points to the long historical tradition that the Maganistas, the PLM, were living within. And so going back to the Spanish colonial period, of course, you have the dominance of the Catholic Church over society and politics. And with the war for revolution, the Mexican War for Independence between 1810 and 1821. One of the goals of the people who were fighting that revolution, of some of the people fighting the revolution, was to diminish the power of the Catholic Church in governance. And so the group that comes out of the revolution, proclaiming themselves to be liberals in the liberal tradition, have worked for decades by the early 20th century to curb the power of the Catholic Church in Mexico. And so the Maganistas are working within that tradition in the sense that their quarrel was with the power of the institution of the Catholic Church. Some were people of faith, but disagreed with the power of the church. That would evolve over time as some members of the PLM would become anarchists, and they were, you know, steadfast against the church and private property and the state altogether. So that's the long tradition that they were working within.
Can you comment on the American role in repressing and suppressing the Maganista revolt?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the centerpiece of the story, is to recall and remember the centrality of U.S. agents in trying to suppress the outbreak of a revolution in Mexico. So Very quickly after Ricardo Flores Magón and his friends arrive in the United States, the Diaz regime reaches out to the U.S. government and says, yo, you've got these radicals up there. We need to silence them. They're trying to cause problems. And the United States government, like the U.S. Department of State and others, keeps their eye on them. But it's an outbreak of a labor revolt, labor strike at an American-owned mine in Cananea, Mexico, that turns violent, that gets the attention of the United States government in the sense that if Mexican workers were going to revolt against U.S. investors in Mexico, and if there was some kind of relationship between these dissidents that had arrived in the United States and that revolt, they wanted to shut down that social movement that was growing. So it's after that uprising in Cananea, Mexico in 1906 that the United States government really goes all in trying to suppress the PLM. The U.S. Department of State instructs consular officials in Mexico and in the borderlands in particular to keep tabs on Mexican rebels in northern Mexico. One consular official from Mexico actually spends a considerable amount of time traveling across the borderlands and working with U.S. marshals and others to coordinate arrests. The U.S. Department of Labor and Commerce, which oversees immigration service, works with Arizona Rangers and others to arrest as many Magonistas as possible and to deport them out of the country into the hands of the Mexican government. There are other cases in which U.S. marshals and others arrest Magonistas across Texas, Oklahoma, and elsewhere, subject them to extradition campaigns. And so these are all actions of the United States government and U.S. agents on the government payroll to try to suppress the outbreak of the Mexican Revolution. And it didn't work. Right. So the PLM is always able to stay just one step ahead of the cross-border counterinsurgency campaign. And by 1910, they had really sowed the seeds for mass revolt.
As a final question to ask you before we wrap up, you end the book with the following quote: "The men and women who built the PLM were ordinary people, migrants, exiles, and citizens, farm workers, sharecroppers, miners, intellectuals. Most of all, they were rebels. Despite their internal disputes, they comprised an extraordinary political source. In the process of confronting the Diaz regime in Mexico, they rattled the U.S. empire, challenged the global color line, threatened to unravel the industrialization of the American West, and fueled the rise of policing in the United States. Ultimately, the uprising they incited triggered a demographic revolution, giving birth to what is now the largest non-white population in the United States. Even after the PLM collapsed, their legacy inspired one of the most significant race rebellions and massacres in U.S. history. Some of the most powerful people on earth tried to suppress them and their story, but Ricardo Flores Magón and the Magonistas altered the course of history, defining the world in which we live by defying the world in which they lived." Why did you end the book with these specific words?
Well, it's really hard to sum up the Magonista story, right? Because their legacy lived on and continues to as inspiration to many radical organizers. But I think at the end of this book, I wanted to emphasize the fact that what bound this group together was their defiance of a social, political, and economic order. And that in my greatest and wildest dreams, right, Latinx youth in particular are able to read this book and see themselves in this history, that they too are ordinary people and that they can be extraordinary historical actors. And so I think that's why I wanted to end the book with that particular statement about the ordinariness of them as human beings, right? They're problematic, they've got issues, they're human, most important, but they also had dreams. Right. And they had a community that they built with, and they imagined a world different than the one that they were given. And so that's why I ended the book that way.
Is it okay to ask you, what are you working on now? Is your current research project? What have you been working on next after this particular book as a subsequent project?
Well, very briefly, I'm working on my Million Dollar Hoods project that I do with a group of scholars based in Los Angeles and by scholars, I mean people who are formally at the university and people who are the leaders of the movement and mass incarceration in LA. So I'm spending quite a bit of time with Million Dollar Hoods and thinking about my next book project.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
As we bring our dialogue to a close today, I'm Ari Barbalat, your host on the New Books Network podcast. I've been blessed to be in dialogue today with Professor Kelly Lytle Hernandez. We have been discussing her new book, Bad Mexicans, Race, Empire, and Revolution in the Borderlands, published by Norton & Company, 2022. Dr. Hernandez is Thomas Lifka Endowed Chair in History and Director of the Ralph J. Bunche Center for African American Studies at UCLA, University of California at Los Angeles. Thank you.
Thank you very much.